The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is John Ivey from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the May 2019 issue of Sports Illustrated for Kids. We're going to begin today on page 8, Who's Who for Sports. We have first Nikola Jokic, center for the Denver Nuggets, the NBA. His height is 7 feet tall. His weight is 250 pounds. He was born February 19, 1995, in Sombor, Serbia. Through March 13th, Jokic led the Nuggets in points 20.4, rebounds 10.7, and assists 7.6 per game. In February, he became Denver's first player in the All-Star game since 2010-2011. Jokic was a member of the Serbian national team that won silver at the 2016 Olympics. In a 94-91 group stage loss to the United States, he scored 25 points. The Nuggets selected Jokic 41st overall in 2014. After averaging 10 points per game in 2015-16, he was named to the All-Rookie First Team. Question: who was the last Nuggets player to make an All-NBA team? Answer: Carmelo Anthony. Next, we have Mitch Marner, the right wing of the Toronto Maple Leafs. His height is 6 feet. His weight is 175 pounds. He was born May 5, 1997, in Markham, Ontario. Through March 14th, Marner led the Maple Leafs with 84 points in 70 games. In that same span, his 60 assists is ranked 4th in the NHL. His previous career high had been 69 points in 82 games last season. Marner had 24 primary assists in the first 25 games of this season, a pace topped only in the past 20 seasons by Mario Lemieux in 2002-2003. After the Maple Leafs selected him fourth overall in 2015, Marner scored 116 points in 57 games with the OHL's London Knights. Question: when did Maple Leafs last win the Stanley Cup? Answer: 1967. And finally, Saquon Barkley, running back of the New York Giants. His height is 5'11". His weight is 233 pounds. He was born February 9, 1997, in Bronx, New York. Barkley won Offensive Rookie of the Year and All-Rookie Team honors after compiling 2,028 yards from scrimmage and 15 touchdowns in his first season with the Giants. In the Giants' Week 17 loss to the Cowboys, Barkley caught his 89th pass of the season, breaking Reggie Bush's record for receptions by a rookie running back. New York drafted Barkley out of Penn State with the second pick in 2018. He was the Big Ten Offensive Player of the Year in 2016 and 2017. Question: who was the 2017 NFL Offensive Rookie of the Year? Answer: Alvin Kamara of the New Orleans Saints. And finally, we have Tohoka Natitkok. She's of the Attack on the Albany Soccer. Her height is 6'1". His weight is 248 pounds. He was born January 19, 1998 in Six Nations, Ontario. As a freshman, Nedicote scored 50 goals in 19 games, earning America East Rookie of the Year and All-Conference first-team honors. Nedicote's stick skills have landed him on multiple SportsCenter top 10 reels, including a one-handed between-the-legs goal in a scrimmage against John Hopkins in 2017. In 2016, he represented the Iroquois national team at the Under-19 World Championships in Canada. Nedicote was named Best Attackman of the tournament. Question: who won the 2018 Major League Lacrosse Championship? Answer: the Denver Outlaws. The Golden Age. Adults always talk about how sports were better when they were kids. Too bad they're wrong. How do we know? Look around. Athletics have never been better than they are right now. One day you kids will look back and realize you grew up during the Golden Age. We have the Lakers. Best yet. The modern superstars do it all, and they can do it better than anyone else in the history of their sports. A time of titans. So here we have LeBron James. We have baseball. We have Roger Federer in tennis. Let's find out about these titans of the Golden Age. All right, prove that sports have never been better. You don't need to compare the stars of every person who has ever played. Just study the top. In every major sport, there's an active athlete with a credible claim to the mantle of greatest of all time, or GOAT. Roger Federer, Simone Biles, Tom Brady, LeBron James, Mike Trout, Serena Williams, Lionel Messi, Katie Ledecky. The list goes on. You may want to quibble with a few of these picks. I see you, Michael Jordan fans, but look at the big picture. At what other time in history could you make the case for so many players as GOATs? Babe Ruth, 1920s, Bill Russell, 60s, and Joe Montana, 80s, weren't exactly contemporaries. And that's to say nothing of how athletes are always getting bigger, stronger, and faster. Any hypothetical matchup between the old and the new will always end in a rout for the better-trained 21st century star. Forget whether Babe Ruth could hit a fastball from Clayton Kershaw. He probably couldn't even hit one from LeBron James. Number two, the way they're meant to be played. It turns out the pretty play actually was the right one all along. As recently as 15 years ago, baseball teams stashed lumbering sluggers in left field and hoped their defensive miscues wouldn't cancel out their contributions at the plate. Basketball games turned on which team's center could outmuscle his opposite in the paint for 48 minutes. And the NFL still featured teams trying to grind out wins with a run-first offense instead of using a high-flying passing attack. Boy, did those games stink to watch. And now we don't have to anymore, thanks to an unlikely hero, math. Statistical revolutions throughout sports have helped teams optimize their strategies. Three-pointers and trips to the free-throw line have replaced the mid-range jumper. Gold-glove fielding and stacked bullpens have become the envy of the manager trying to maximize his run prevention. In the NHL, coaches have realized that games are won in the neutral zone and have stopped dumping and chasing the puck into the offensive zone so often. Games from past eras don't look unrecognizable because tastes were different. Rather, coaches didn't know the optimal tactics and athletes weren't trained to execute them. Infield shifts. Major League Baseball managers adjust their defenses regularly. Many fielders now keep reference cards in their back pockets. Number three, a league of their own. The term Golden Age can describe the best period of something, but it can also mean the original era, a fondly remembered beginning. Women's sports in the United States may be experiencing both kinds of Golden Age simultaneously. In individual sports, which have a rich professional history, the athletes have never been more dominant. Serena Williams has won more Grand Slam singles titles than any other player, male or female, in the Open era. With 13 World Championship gold medals, Simone Biles, just 22, is the most decorated gymnast ever. And Michaela Schifrin is already the all-time leader in Women's World Cup slalom wins at age 24. Meanwhile, women's team sports may be experiencing the birth of their own big four leagues. The WNBA is 23 years old and now joined by the National Women's Soccer League, started play in 2013, the National Women's Hockey League, 2015, and the United Women's Lacrosse League, 2016. There's still a lot of room to grow, and that's exciting. Number four, the kids are more than all right. Unfortunately, we're going to have to do this feature again in 5 years or come up with a term for something better than a golden age. Platinum epoch? The up-and-coming stars are just that good. It makes sense that as training techniques improve, so would the athleticism of amateurs. But strength alone can't explain how stars like Clemson quarterback Trevor Lawrence below and Duke forward Zion Williamson on the right look pro-ready as teenagers. High school and college games used to be more distinct from the pros. Now kids focus on the skills that will suit them at the highest levels. Lawrence was recruited as a pro-style quarterback. In baseball, pitchers learn techniques to throw faster. Once considered an innate product of strength, young players are training harder and smarter. 5. Any team, anytime, anywhere. Believe it or not, back in the day, people picked their favorite team based on where they lived. No, seriously. If you lived in Cincinnati, you'd root for the Cincinnati Reds. If you resided in Orlando, you'd cheer for the Orlando Magic. Crazy, right? Thanks to technology, you don't have to get stuck rooting for a bad team. The internet and TV have made every fan cards available to every fan all over the world. Are you an FC Barcelona nut who resides in Topeka, Kansas? You can get up-to-the-minute updates on Lionel Messi's pregame doings at weird hours in the morning. This 24-hour access has made it easier to become a full-time superfan, but it's also made fandom more of a personal statement and not just something you inherit. Follow whichever team you like, as much as you want, for whatever reason. There's no wrong way to row. On the other hand, a rebuttal from your elder managing editor, Mark Bechtel. First things first, you young whippersnappers, when I was your age, I never would have sassed my elders. No siree. You never catch me telling my pappy or my pappy's pappy he had the wrong idea about something. That sort of thing just grinds me gears. I tell you, but more than that, the impertinence of this whole confounded article is the fact that it just isn't right, by golly. Why, the notion that Clayton Kershaw could throw a speedball past Babe Ruth is poppycock. The Bambino could hit anything thrown his way, a fastball, a curveball, a changeup, a tomato thrown from the upper deck. Crowds were a lot nastier in those days, but it built character, I tell you. You want to talk about a mismatch? How about sending Mike Trout up to face Mordecai? Three fingers, Brown's drop ball. Yes, sir, he lost two fingers on his twirling hand working on his pappy's farm, but it only made him better. None of these fancy summer baseball camps for the old-time great hurlers. They learn the hard way by throwing rocks at tree stumps. Now, this isn't to say that the newfangled ball players are all bad. But back in the day, the game was played by regular Joes. They had jobs in the off-season, and the stadiums were at amusement parks. Baseball and football players would leave the field covered in dirt and grass stains. A fellow would have to suss out how to beat his opponent. We didn't rely on machines or scouting reports, and there was an air of mystery to players. When Wilt Chamberlain came to town, you went to see him play, because not every Warriors game was on TV. In closing, let me say, progress is nice, but so is a classic performance by golly. Now get off my lawn. The last word, don't listen to this geezer, kids. He's only sticking up for Babe Ruth because he's old enough to have babysat the Bambino. Not a day goes by this office in which he doesn't tell a really interesting story that I love to hear. Help, he's looking right at me. And it shows this old geezer on a typewriter with the Bambino in the background. Mush it to the limit. Go behind the scenes on a photographer's journey to cover the grueling Iditarod dog sled race. The Iditarod sled dog race is quite an adventure for the competitors. Teams of up to 14 dogs pull mushers across the Alaskan wilderness. It's also an adventure for spectators and journalists who are sent to cover the race, such as Eric Roscoe on the right, who took these photographs. It's not like anyone can just drive around the course. It's covered in snow and ice. And even if it weren't, there aren't the roads. To get to the Rainy Pass checkpoint, Eric flew in on a plane, pictured above, that has skis on the wheel so it can land on the snow. And it's not as if there are cozy hotels all over the place. Eric spent a few nights sleeping on the floor of a church gymnasium. He met some interesting people, including Nick Hansen, who has competed on American Ninja Warrior. Nick invited Eric to stay in his home in the town of Unalakleet, and he gave him a taste of local cuisine, including whale meat. It was one of the wildest assignments I've ever had, says Eric. And here we have a picture of some of the dogs on their mushers on their sleds running through the snow. Number one, slush fund. The weather was relatively warm during the race, which meant that the snow melted on parts of the course. That made things challenging for the dogs who had to slog through slush. Number two, cold rush. The teams covered nearly 1,000 miles from Anchorage to Nome. Before planes and snowmobiles, dog sleds were the primary mode of transportation for getting supplies and mail across Alaska. And three, lighten up. Believe it or not, the dogs actually prefer to run when it's colder out. So some mushers race on through the night and rest in the day, using headlamps to light their way. Number four, waterway. Late in the Iditarod, teams race along the Bering Sea coast. Because of climate change, less of that area is frozen over. Concerns over open water have led to rerouting of the course. Number five, dog days. Only dogs that thrive in cold conditions are allowed to compete. That means no poodles, though they have raced in the past. Most of the dogs in the competition are Malamutes or Huskies. Six, winner. The first of the 39 mushers to cross the finish line was Peter Kaiser. His time of 9 days, 12 hours, and 39 minutes, and 6 seconds was 12 minutes faster than the runner-up. Number 7, hey there. The race rules require mushers to make stops to allow their dogs to eat, rest, and sleep. Some of the dogs like to snooze under blankets, while others prefer beds of hay. 13-year-old Elisa Liu is the future of United States figure skating, but the future will have to wait. On a Saturday morning in February, Elisa Liu was riding in the back seat of her dad's car with a little dog, Zuzu. She was playing Fortnite on her phone while her dad, Arthur, drove her to the Oakland Ice Arena for another day of skating and off-ice training. As Elisa got out of the car, she bent over to say goodbye to Zuzu. She had picked out the skinny terrier mix with wispy white fur a few weeks earlier as a reward for winning the United States Figure Skating Championships. Elisa giggled, grabbed her suitcase full of skating gear and homemade slime, and shut the door. Elisa's bouncy stride matches her upbeat personality. She wore her hair gathered in a large round donut bun, as she does every single day she skates, which is basically every day of her life. The bun seems comically large on her tiny 4'8" frame. As she laced up her skates, Alyssa chattered breathlessly, switching topics as fast as she spins on the ice. She pulled out a Tupperware full of homemade slime. This one is a turquoise lump with multicolored foam beads. She asked if she could call this one Alien Crisp or Alien Popcorn. She also wanted to know if a visitor had seen her favorite funny cat video on Instagram. You know, the one in which the cat gets a brain freeze after eating ice cream? Alyssa is the most impressive female figure skater that the United States has seen in years. But she's just 13 years old and will be relying on ride to the rink from dad for 2.5 more years. In January, Alyssa was crowned the youngest ever United States figure skating national champion. She is now being hailed as the future of the sport, one in which United States women have not won an Olympic medal since 2006. But Alyssa can't jump right away into the role of top United States skater. Because of her age, she has to wait until she turns 15 to compete internationally at the senior level. So, until then, she'll focus on practicing, playing Fortnite, hanging with Juliana, her best friend forever, the one she shares the matching yellow mini backpacks with, and watching silly videos of cats getting brain freezes on Instagram. And here we have a picture of Alyssa on page 41. One giant leap. Alyssa burst onto the scene in her first senior nationals in Detroit when she landed 3 clean triple axels, a feat that no American woman had ever achieved at nationals. The triple axel is the most difficult triple jump because the forward takeoff and backward landing make it 3.5 rotations. And Alyssa's first triple axel in her long program was even more difficult because it was done in combination with another difficult jump, the double toe loop. She was the youngest skater in the senior division field by 2 years, but Alyssa was the only competitor who even attempted a triple axel. Alyssa is so short that silver medalist Brady Tennell, 20, and bronze medalist Mariah Bell, 22, had to grab both her arms to lift her up to the top spot on the podium. Bell wasn't surprised. The teensy 13-year-old won it all. When you're 13 and you're young, it's so exciting to go out there and show everything you've got, Bell says. As you get older, you have a different mindset, like, okay, I have this and this to lose. You can see it in her. She just goes out there to take it all. Olympic gold medalist Tara Lipinski, who won the 1997 Nationals as a 14-year-old, previously held the record for youngest national champion. Lipinski, who won a gold medal at the 1998 Olympics in Nagano, is now a figure skating analyst for NBC Sports. After hearing Lou's name, she looked her up on YouTube a few months before Nationals. Before the poor quality video had even landed, Lipinski sent a text to one of her NBC producers and a couple skating friends. This is going to be our new national champion. To Lipinski, Alyssa is more than just the youngest to ever win the Nationals. She's also the one to lead the United States women's figure skating team to redemption in Beijing. Other skaters have to live up to what Alyssa is putting on out there, Lipinski says. She doesn't even realize the impact she's making just on how she'll push lady skaters in the United States who have lagged behind. And if Alyssa can learn to consistently nail a quad jump, the most difficult in the world, she could be unstoppable. Her triple axel has already changed the game, and now she's able to compete with the best of them, says Lipinski. When she adds a quad, if she does at some point, it marks the day in history where United States ladies will be, and she might be, the one to beat. Father knows best. Arthur Liu first enrolled Alyssa in skating lessons when she was 5. Arthur, 54, is a lawyer, mostly serving Oakland's Chinese community. He used to drive past the Oakland Ice Arena every day on his way to his office. As a Chinese immigrant, he closely followed the career of Michelle Kwan, the two-time Olympic medalist for the United States, who is the daughter of Chinese immigrants. He thought the sport would be perfect for his fearless daughter. Alyssa took to the ice immediately, a small blur chasing around older skaters and hockey players. She quickly formed a special bond with Laura Lipetsky, who has been her coach since her first lesson. She got on the ice like it was nothing, Arthur says. She was just having so much fun chasing people. She was unafraid of the slippery ice. Lipetsky remembers Alyssa soaking up everything she was taught. At the end of her first lesson, a sad Alyssa asked, "Oh, it's over already?" Alyssa quickly became the darling of the Oakland Ice Arena. All the older skaters wanted to play with her because she was so adorable in her big jacket and her bright pink skates. Arthur had limited knowledge of figure skating before Alyssa began taking lessons. But with Lipetsky's help, he created a practice checklist to keep Alyssa on track when she trained on her own. "I have the Coach Arthur rule," he says. "Everything five times, like double axel, five good double axels. If you fall, that doesn't count." By the time Alyssa was in sixth grade, Arthur knew she had real potential as a figure skater. So he decided to homeschool her to maximize her time at the rink and allow for flexibility to travel to competitions. She's currently taking classes at the 9th and 10th grade levels. Alyssa now typically skates 7 days a week. On the weekdays, she spends most of the day at the rink, with breaks in between sessions to go out to lunch with her skating friends or play Fortnite. She goes to her dad's office two or three afternoons each week to do her schoolwork. Alyssa gave her gold medal from nationals to Arthur, who says, she says, deserved it more than me. Hometown hero. Alyssa took a rickety elevator up to the second floor of a run-down office suite called Excellent Commercial Center. Arthur's law office shares the second floor with driving schools, acupuncturists, and accountants. Many of the storefronts are identified only by Chinese characters. Alyssa has shown her small cubicle here at Dad's office, where she does schoolwork. She walks Zuzu down the block to Lincoln Park, the home of her favorite mural, which features smiling cartoon pandas. Alyssa wandered over to the bakery that makes the best pineapple buns and then sat down on a bench near the plaza fountain to enjoy the treat. Zuzu sniffed at the crumbs falling from the flaky bun. Lately, Alyssa has been studying Mandarin, which she used to speak when she was younger but lost when she stopped attending Chinese school. She doesn't yet know the word for Olympics, which will be the next held in Beijing. "That should be in my vocabulary," she says. No biggie. She's got 3 years to practice that. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Sports Illustrated for Kids. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm John Ivey, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138.